wannabe historian, and I'm a wannabe theologian. And as a wannabe theologian and historian, I'm enthralled by aftermaths, coming to conclusions based on an act in history or a discovery in theology, a discovery in revelation. The aftermath of those is really what it's about. The aftermath is what we do with it. The aftermath is our present and our future of what we do. So, I mean, that's my bread and butter. That's my playground. That's my Disney World. It's aftermaths. However, there's one aftermath that I have detested all my life, and I still detest it. December 26th through January 1. I hatest, mostest that aftermath. If it were up to me, I'd take the decorations down at midnight, December 26th. Why? Because the decorations are just a reminder that it's over. I've always been that way. I've been in love with Christmas ever since I was a kid. Even before I knew who Jesus was, I was in love with Christmas. And I've loved it ever since. So I started looking forward to it in October. And fall and winter are my favorite. Everything is my favorite. But I've conceded that not everybody feels that way. So I will leave my decorations up until New Year's Day. Ask my wife, though. New Year's morning, they are down. I'm done. I'm done with the aftermath. So today is something I thought I'd never do. Still do some Christmas after Christmas. So thank you, Helen and Bev and Melissa, for keeping us there. Helen asked me last week, she said, is it okay if we still do some carols? She was behind me when she asked. She didn't see my face. My face was almost, oh, absolutely not. It's December 27th. No. In fact, I'm going to call Bev and have the decorations removed. No, no. And Bev, that's not what I meant. So. But thank you. So I want to do a little aftermath today. Because where would we be without the aftermath to Christmas? Where would we be without the aftermath of what we celebrated? Where we all live is we live in the aftermath for nearly 2,000 years now. Isn't it been an aftermath since year one? So we're reminded that there's a lot in history that leaves us in mystery when it comes to the birth and the immediate aftermath of his birth. So, as a theologian, I would like to find some aspect, at least with the Christmas story, that is built in to aftermath. And I think there is one element, biblical element, that keeps us there, and that would be certainly the visit of the three kings, the visit of the Magi, the visit of the three wise men. It's church tradition and church tradition alone that places that event on the actual night that he was born, and it is the most unlikely to have occurred. It probably happened a few months later. So, hey, how about that? I have something that I can go to as still Christmas, but what? An aftermath. The visit was an aftermath. So we don't know. So it makes a nice element of aftermath. It allows a perfect introduction to the aftermath of the birth of King of Kings, to talk about kings, to talk about emperors and rulers and kingdoms, the most important lessons of the aftermath. The most important lessons of the aftermath is that our definition of power has been changed. Our definition of king and kingdom has been redefined and overruled for all those of us who believe that it was the King of Kings who was born on Christmas Day. The power articulated by this world and defined by this world no longer defines us, no longer defines people who believe. Why? Because we live in the aftermath. The world that has a familiar ring to it, that Jesus was born into, the before math, the during math, and the aftermath. Philip Yancey, in his book, The Jesus I Never Knew, more accurately or articulately narrates the world that Jesus was born into. He begins with Mary. Mary clues us in her first praise to God that she was going to be the one that would carry this baby. In her prayer, she said, He's shown strength. God has shown strength with His what? With His arm. He's scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He's brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. There were powerful people sitting on thrones. There were proud people that needed to be scattered. 8 days later of the aftermath, Simeon grasps something that maybe no one else did. When he sees the baby, he's blessed them and he says to his mother Mary, this child is destined for the falling and the rising of many in Israel and to be a sign that will be opposed so that the inner thoughts of many will be revealed and a sword will pierce your own soul too. He sensed that aside from the birth of this baby, nothing else had changed. Jerusalem's streets are full of beggars and starving and crippled and widows and orphans the way they always have been. A world superpower is crucifying Jewish patriots. A puppet of that superpower rules over Judea and rules with an iron hand. Jesus was born under Caesar Augustus, a time when hope wafts through the Roman Empire. More than any other ruler, Augustus raised the expectations of what a leader could accomplish, what a society could achieve. Augustus borrows the Greek word to describe his reign, the Greek word for gospel, the good news. He borrowed it and he applied it to his reign as a label for this new world order that he was ushering in. He was declared a god, and he established rites of worship for him. Many believed that this enlightened regime would last forever. The final solution to the problem of government was Augustus, and it was good news. Then think about it. Before the aftermath, when the world was given examples of what power is like and what power needs to be worshipped before the aftermath in this little obscure corner of Augustus's empire, a baby is born. No history books record it. We know of it mainly through four short books given to us 30 to 60 years after the events occurred. These biographers would claim the word gospel too. They would redefine it in the aftermath. They proclaim a different kind of new world order. They mention Augustus only once. The Gospels only mention Augustus once. And it's a reference to the date of a census that brings Jesus to Bethlehem. That is the only mention of this superpower that the world has come to worship. The aftermath, the baby's life. It's a menacing preview for what's about to happen. It's a menacing preview for what the aftermath is going to look like. The powerful still play their hand in the aftermath, even to today, do they not? Do the powerful who still believe that they're all powerful still exercise that power? As if they're really, truly the ones that have power. This puppet ruler that I mentioned, Jewish by name only, but the enforcer of Rome in Judea. His name was Herod the Great. Yet, how do we know his name? How are we introduced to Herod the Great? He's mentioned only once in the Gospels, too. Augustus mentioned only once, and Herod mentioned only once, and we associate it with Christmas because it's associated with the aftermath. the visit of the wise men, recognizing a sign that there was a new king, a new kind of king that was born. The aftermath puts his reign of power, a baby's cry, so far from Jerusalem and Rome, they don't know where to find him. Remember, they visited Herod, because certainly a king would know what was going on. They visited Herod, and they naively assumed that he would welcome the sign the way that everybody should welcome the sign. But new kings, instead of you, is not a welcome sign to a king who's already on his throne. New kings have one priority. Old kings have one priority, and that is they make sure that there are no new kings. They will hold on to their power. But the aftermath comes after that power. Herod didn't react very well. When Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the Magi, because remember, he told the Magi, when you find him, come tell me where he is so that I may come and what? And worship him. But they, warned by an angel, went another way back home. And he was infuriated, and he sent and he killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, according to the time he had learned from the Magi. He couldn't pick the actual baby, so he would make sure that he took care of all of the babies. See, we know of Herod the Great only because of this. Only because of this one event. By the way, secular history doesn't record this event at all either. It doesn't record the atrocity. But if you study a little history, no one doubts that he's capable of it. If you knew him just a little. He killed two brothers-in-law. He killed his own wife, Mariamne. He killed two of his sons. 5 days before his death, he ordered the arrest of many citizens and decreed that they be executed on the day of his death in order to guarantee a proper atmosphere of mourning in the country. Scarcely a day passed in Herod's reign that an execution did not take place under his regime. And what is said in the annals of the Roman Senate, in other words, when the first people that began to explore the empire, when they came into power, and they report back to Rome what goes on in this place, a little to know about it. The general that comes back to report on Herod told them, in an asterisk to his report, you don't turn your back on this one. So in the aftermath, this is what the power looks like. The aftermath of power we don't want to think about at Christmas. You only think about it in the next couple of months after. Israel had been warned 800 years before, you don't want a king. Absolutely not, God said. Not for my people. Because again, the primary focus for any king is to stay on the throne. The threat of being overthrown was constant. That threat, that fear is what drives all history's kings. Some may have handled it a little better than others, but all have been driven by it to an extent in all of history. In the aftermath, this is what power leaves us. This is what the old version, the old definition of power leaves us. This is what it looks like. So the aftermath, but also before the math, the world's power has never changed. And it was why Israel was to never have a king. In our scripture reading, Isaiah gives that most famous of messianic prophecies, foretelling the earthquake that this aftermath would redefine the power. Remember, it begins this way: the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. Isaiah is prophesying. He's talking about them going to war with the Midianites. And the Midianites had won. And they had kept them captive. They had kept them underneath. And a rod of oppression needs to be broken. He said, you're the one that broke it. He's to break the yoke of burden on the oppressed. It's what kings should do. Was there oppressed in Isaiah's day? Of course there was. But his prophecies, by the way, are about to foretell an oppressor that will make them oppressed. A certain king in Babylon. And how are the yokes of oppression broken in the aftermath? How are they broken before the aftermath, if you will? The way he says. For all the boots of the tramping warriors and all the garments rolled in blood shall be burned as fuel for the fire. His burdened people were supposed to have a light made for them, by the way, coming by way of Galilee into the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. Their yoke will be broken by their oppressor. Their oppressor will be broken. How? Look, by tramping warriors, by boots and garments rolled in blood. It makes sense. Fear, vengeance, it's how it's done. That's power in the aftermath. That's power that the aftermath needs to address. And when you hear of oppressed people and you see a promise of oppression to be lifted, we all cheer. It makes sense. Vengeance is how it's done. Get it done now, please, God. But the aftermath said, wait a minute. Hang on. You're expecting warriors. You're expecting blood. But I've got the aftermath for you. For a child has been born unto us. Think of the authority resting on the tiny shoulders of the newborn. We have to redefine power in the aftermath. We redefine it as what it means to us, what it really is, and by the way, what we then begin to teach people, other people, what it really is. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of War, a war by peace, power by powerlessness. Melissa had a line in the song that power steps into weakness. The aftermath redefines power. See, when Herod died, an angel reports to Joseph and Mary that it's okay for them to go back. After they left, Joseph and Mary were told that they needed to flee to Egypt. He spends his infancy there. And after Herod dies, remember the same angel? Well, we don't know if it's the same angel. But they were told that it was okay to return. But what happened? They were going to go back to Bethlehem, but Herod's son Archelaus was ruling there. He lasted 10 years ruling Judea and Samaria and Idumea, but was almost as brutal as his father. He scandalized the Jews by marrying his brother's widow. He deposed 2 high priests. So that's why they moved to Nazareth, where Herod's other son, Antipas, is ruling. He has the same tendencies as his brother. He repudiates his first wife, then marries his brother's wife, Herodias. This is what John the Baptist calls him out on. And when John the Baptist did that, Herod now has an excuse to what? To behead him. Again, the world fights the redefining of the aftermath. The world still fights with the power that it has. The very hour Pharisees came to him, to Jesus, to tell him about Antipas, he says, get away, for Herod wants to kill you. He said to them, go and tell that fox for me, listen, I'm casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work. The world's power is still operating around him. They're trying to give him pointers on how to survive what the world's power wants to do to him. You need to get away. He's going to murder you. Jesus says, I'm about something else. I'll show you what power really is. I'll cast out demons. I will heal. And on the third day, my work will be what? It'll be finished. I don't play by that fox's rules, Jesus says. I came to redefine power, not to use the power that was already here, even against my enemies. All power, all authority, he chooses to cast out demons. He chooses to heal from sickness. He chooses to proclaim good news to the poor and the oppressed. But he won't fight as kings fight, not in the aftermath. Our King of Kings doesn't look like a king in the aftermath. As a matter of fact, he isn't. He's a shepherd. In a few years, the Romans will take direct command of the southern province. They've had it with the Herod family. And they say that that rebellion has always taken place. So rather than being a protectorate of Rome, it will then translate into being a part of the empire. So they'll take direct control of that southern province. Place the cruelest, most notorious governor in charge of this place, a man named Pontius Pilate. He was well connected. He knew what power was like. He married the granddaughter of Augustus. According to Luke, Pilate and Herod were enemies until one day they came together, the one time that they agreed, in order to determine the destiny of that little country rabbi from Galilee. Get rid of the pretender. Get rid of this new king. Preserve our power in the aftermath, in their little corner of the kingdom. Political murder, war, rampant greed, dissidents, revolutions, mass slaughter. The world he was born into. Is the world the same today? In the aftermath, it is. But we're reminded, though, we don't fight by these rules anymore. We don't live that way anymore. Because that King of Kings, that Lord of Lords, that good shepherd over us all, in the aftermath, redefines where our power lies. Redefines that our strength is in our weakness. That the power of the world and the wisdom of the world are foolish, absolutely foolish to us. By the way, the new definition of power is foolish to them. We become wise by becoming fools. Nothing better than to be a fool for Christ. Nothing worse than just to be a fool. Right? To be a fool for no reason, but when you get to be a fool for Christ, wow, that's what I want. So our challenge in the aftermath is, our choice will always be, what power are we going to live by? Are we going to live in the aftermath? Are we going to live by the aftermath's power? Or are we going to live by the aftermath's power only until it hurts? And then once it starts to hurt, we begin to dabble where? In the other world's power. As with the Pharisees of old, we can talk and walk a pretty good game, can't we? But when push comes to shove, what will we do when it requires some real Jesus actions? To begin to forgive, to begin to love, to truly begin to humble ourselves. Yancey finished the chapter on the visited planet with this. He said, there is a line from Mozart's Requiem. Remember, merciful Jesu, that I am the cause of your journey. The aftermath power fought by humility and love and forgiveness. Our movement is the aftermath of Christmas. Our movement is because our king rules as a shepherd of a kingdom, not of this world. We live by another kingdom's rules in the aftermath. Even though the power of the before math has its way with this world and will always have its way with this world. those of us who lived, those of us who celebrated 2 days ago of the birth of the King of Kings, we live by different rules. We redefine power in our lives. We become fools. Our movement comes in the aftermath of Christmas. Our King rules as a shepherd of a kingdom, not of this world. We live by another set of rules. We don't have a king. We have a good shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep and only asks that we do the same. In the same chapter of the book, Yancey puts it this way. A today movement, an undefined power or unredefined power. Today certainly would be political movements. And political movements by nature, they draw lines, they make distinctions. They pronounce judgment. In contrast, Jesus' love cuts across those lines, transcends distinctions, dispenses grace. Regardless of the merits of a given issue, political movements, civil movements, arguments, debates, theological movements, arguments over history, arguments over who we are and why. All of those risk pulling themselves into a mantle of power that will smother love. Ellen White once wrote, she said, no one was ever won to Christ by a position of moral support superiority. In other words, nobody ever truly was won to Christ by a debate. Nobody was ever won to Christ by an act of power over them. Our power comes from under. Our power serves. From Jesus, I learned that whatever I get involved in, it must not drive out love and humility. Otherwise, I betray the kingdom of heaven. Former presidential speechwriter Michael Gershon said that evangelical Christians are going to be known for their ethical agenda above and over the story of the gospel, then they are finished. I believe this applies to all Christians, to all of us, not just those identifying as evangelical. Why is it we seem to care more that people know what we believe on any particular issue as opposed to caring that other people know we care for them? Two kings, Herod and Jesus, personified very different kinds of power. Herod had legions of Roman soldiers to enforce his will. He had temple guard. He had armies to enforce his will. History records how Herod used his power, stole his brother's wife, locked up all dissenters, beheaded John the Baptist as a party trick. Jesus too had power. But he used it compassionately. He fed the hungry. He healed the sick. Herod had a gold crown, palaces, guards, and all the visible tokens of royalty. For Jesus, the closest thing to a formal coronation or Messiah's anointing occurred in an embarrassing scene when a disreputable woman poured perfume on his head. He got the title King of the Jews as a criminal sentence. His crown was made of thorns, and it was more than just a source of pain. And though he could have called on a legion of angels for protection, he declined. Consistently, Jesus refused to use any coercive power. He knowingly let one of his disciples betray him, then surrendered himself without protest to his captors. It never ceases to amaze me that Christian hope rests on a man whose message was rejected, whose love was spurned, and was condemned as a criminal and given a death sentence. When he lived on earth, he made the blind to see and the lame to walk. He'll return to rule over a kingdom that has no disease or disability. On earth, he died and was resurrected. At his return, death will be no more. On earth, he cast out demons. At his return, he will destroy the evil one. On earth, he came as a baby born in a manger. He'll return as the blazing figure described in the book of Revelation. The kingdom he set into motion on earth was not the end. It was only the beginning of the end. Anyone, a half-breed with five husbands, or an insurrectionist dying on a cross, was welcome to join his kingdom. The person was more important than any category or any label. So in the aftermath, we're not allowed to have anything guide us except faith. Our politics, our causes, not the other way around. It's all that guides us. It's that we are lost sheep in need of a shepherd. Paul put it this way. He said, Jews ask for signs, Greeks desire wisdom. But we proclaim Christ a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. In the aftermath, it's not a war of swords, or the right politics, or debate, or majority rules. In the aftermath, it's one of mangers and crosses, the gentleness of a baby and shepherds. Mangers and crosses make lousy weapons, you know. But in the aftermath, they are our symbols of victory. In the aftermath, the king is redefined as his power is redefined. And it's the only power we're allowed to have, and that is powerlessness. So this is where we find ourselves. So I thank you that you made me stay in Christmas just a couple of days more in order to know who we are and where we are. So I don't get a chance before the new year. Thank you. I want to thank you for the journey that we've been on all year. I want to thank you for taking one of the most horrible years I can remember and making it just a bit better, because I got to spend it in this war with you. We are an army, but we fight by different rules. And it's so hard to do in this planet. That's why the church is us. It's hard to do as individuals. It's impossible as individuals. But when you know you've got somebody with you who will fight by the same rules, who worship the same king, that's what the church is for. That's who we are. That's what we're about. I wish I could tell you that next year was going to be better. But we're a year stronger. Or yet, wait a minute, we're a year weaker. Because we find our power. Find our power in our powerlessness. And if we're going to have to live in the aftermath, I'm glad we get to do it.